Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. It's almost inconceivable to think there have been 35,000 deaths in the U.S. so far this year from gun violence, following 45,000 deaths in the past 2 years. So we're bringing in a longtime gun owner who happens to be a trauma surgeon for Connecticut Children's Health System for a cool, calm, and politics-free conversation about how we can start trending down these horrific losses, so many involving children and young people. Then we're circling back with two representatives from the Connecticut Bureau of the National Resources Conservation Service, a division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, to get the latest on the types of programs and financial and technical assistance they can offer to farmers and other private landowners and managers here in Connecticut directly or through their brand new website. And you probably heard that a little over a month ago, the Fifth Circuit ruled that DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was unconstitutional, and new DACA applications will no longer be allowed. So with over a million undocumented dreamers in our country being forced to continue to live without legal status, we're going to our resource at Immigration Help to get caught up on what you need to know and how that nonprofit may be of assistance. We'll be right back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. National Adoption Month is in November, and it's designed to raise awareness about the critical need for adoptive families for children and youth in foster care. And our friends at Wheeler have just announced a new related initiative serving youth and families in 9 communities, and they're actively and urgently recruiting foster families who can provide stable, safe, caring environments for youth for short durations. If you live in Beacon Falls, Middlebury, Naugatuck, Oxford, Prospect, Southbury, Waterbury, Wolcott, or Woodbury, and you're considering opening up your home to a child or teen who really needs you, call 860-793-7277 or email fostercareprograms@wheelerclinic.org. So we're about a little under a month away from the 10-year mark post Sandy Hook. And as we look across the country, stuff's not getting any better. There have been 35,000 deaths in the U.S. so far this year, following 45,000 deaths in 2020 and the same in 2021 from gun violence. And about 79% of the killings in 2020 involved a firearm, which is the highest percentage since at least 1968. I'm so pleased to be welcoming an individual who's not only been involved in this Connecticut gun buyback initiative that you've been hearing about that happened just a couple of days ago as we're airing this program, but he is also a very experienced trauma surgeon. He's currently with Connecticut Children's Medical System, and he's a longtime gun owner. So, Dr. Brendan Campbell, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're from Connecticut. You've traveled around the country. Have you done your trauma surgeon training across a wide swath of demographics, urban, suburban, and rural, and have seen the sort of the differences in the kinds of gun-related injuries that might be experienced in these different types of areas?
I have. I've been lucky enough to, train in a variety of different places during my 10 years of surgical training. You know, the one common thing is that, gun injuries can be devastating. But I think the important takeaway from a public health standpoint is that the vast majority of these injuries are preventable, whether they're suicides, homicides, or unintentional shootings. And, there are actionable things that, can be done. But as you pointed out in your opening remarks, it's a significant problem that we haven't made a lot of headway at lately.
Yeah, when we're looking at almost 8 out of 10 killings in 2020 involving a firearm, not suicides, intentional acts, and then everything spirals upward from there. And these, unfortunately, are the you know, 2020. It seems like light years passed already. You know, certainly the COVID situation hasn't improved, and the scares that people had during COVID and the boosting of the proportion of gun ownership and the number of guns that gun owners are acquiring or continue to hold is of issue. Yesterday, as we air this on Sunday morning, was the latest Connecticut gun buyback initiative. You've been involved with this program virtually since its inception. Can you talk about, since it's kind, we're kind of straddling taping before but airing after, can you talk a little bit about the history of this program and how you feel and what you hear are the benefits of exchanging cash for the kinds of guns that are coming across the counter at police stations across Connecticut during these programs?
Sure. So gun buybacks aren't a panacea. We'll say that up front. They're not going to fix the problem. But, you know, a public health approach to addressing a complex problem like firearm injury requires community engagement. And what gun buyback programs do is several fold. One, obviously, we are taking unwanted firearms out of people's attics, garages, and homes, and we structure the buyback program in a way that gets those most dangerous guns out of the homes, assault rifles, handguns. You know, we don't care as much about the long guns, the rifles and shotguns. So that's number one. But we also know that the people who come to these events, because we've interviewed them and surveyed them, also keep other guns in their homes. So it allows us to begin a conversation on firearm safety and to distribute, cable gun locks as well as some biometric safes in a way to try and encourage people to store their firearms safely and securely.
So do you find that a proportion of these folks, maybe even a majority of them, may have purchased one or more of the firearms that are bought back in a moment of fear, panic, or out of just the general idea of, yeah, I'm going to get a gun just as self-protection sort of because everybody else is doing it. And then over time, they have begun to realize that it could potentially be a threat, maybe not even to themselves and their family, but if that gun gets into the hands of the wrong person.
Right. You're exactly right. You know, there are 300 million guns out in circulation in the United States, and people acquire them or for a variety of reasons. They might inherit them. Who knows? But I think there are a lot of responsible, you know, Americans out there who own guns, and many times they'll get to a point in their life, whether they either, you know, have small children who might be curious exploring the house or have teenagers like me who, you know, are going through a challenging time in their life and recognize that, you know, not having a gun in the home that I'm not using for anything is probably the best thing. And that's what bring a lot of people in. Or others, you know, they lose a spouse and, you know, they're not into shooting sports or hunting or don't feel like they need a gun for self protection. So there's a lot of different reasons that people bring them in. And I think that buyback provides us an opportunity to help people own guns as safely as possible.
When we talk about trying to better protect the ones who probably most likely can't protect themselves, and that is children, we so often hear about almost exclusively it's either they've been shot accidentally handling a gun or being in the presence of someone who's mishandling a gun. They're caught in the crossfire, so to speak, situations that they are indirectly or not at all involved in. But more increasingly, disturbingly, and it's almost been described by a number of people at epidemic proportions, is the amount of suicides that are occurring by firearm in kids in the middle school to even top end of elementary school age.
That's absolutely correct. So, you know, we hear about mass shootings, we hear about homicides, but suicides are the leading cause of firearm-related injury. What is, I think, difficult for people to understand is the calculus of gun ownership. You know, I grew up in Cheshire, Connecticut, and, you know, the Pettit murders happened distance from the house that I grew up in. And when something like that happens and you hear about it continuously in the news, it makes you think that having a gun for safety or protection might be a good idea. And for some people it is. But with that opportunity to own gun for that reason comes a responsibility to own it safely. And if you look at the risk of guns in your house, the risk of a suicide of a family member, homicide, or unintentional shooting is actually greater than having someone, you know, invade your home or threaten you. So I think it's perfectly fine for people to own guns. It's a constitutionally protected right. But I think you just have to be careful to make it as safe as you can, mostly storing your firearm in a secured way that keeps you and your family at lowest risk of injury.
When we're looking across news reports, especially over the past few years, it seems like, you know, since a little bit before COVID, I mean, you and I grew up in an era of, the crazy secret spy and cop movies and TV shows. Certainly, we've seen our share of exotic military grade type of firearms in the hands of non-military people, bad guys, so to speak. But it really seems, when we're looking at the photos of firearms that are being collected by police agencies right here in Connecticut, we're not seeing the Saturday Night Special, the revolvers. We're seeing some pretty exotic, high-powered, military-grade or modified firearms or ghost guns. We're seeing things like a Glock pistols being modified into full auto with like 30 plus bullet clips being introduced. Are these the kinds of guns that are wreaking havoc and injuring and killing the children that you and your colleagues are seeing across children's emergency health networks?
Yeah, there's no question that a lot of these firearms that, you know, the surge in sales that you alluded to earlier that happened during the pandemic, which was unprecedented, has largely been handguns. And in states where it's legal, semi-automatic, magazine-fed guns. And, you know, I think the thing that we have to decide as a society is, you know, what restrictions we want to have. And, you know, I think as a gun owner who owns long guns and handguns, I think there is a distinction between guns that are used for hunting, shooting sports, and self-defense, and those which can be converted to offensive use, which are those high-capacity semi-automatic guns. And, you know, it's not for me to decide. It's for the state and federal government to decide. But I think those are things that we need to consider when, you know, guns have overtaken motor vehicles as the leading cause of death and injury in our country.
Well, it's one thing for lawmakers to hear from grieving survivors of gun violence, but when you and your legion of colleagues across the United States come together to try to advise decision-making lawmakers, whether it's at the state house level or in Washington, I know early on, shortly after the Sandy Hook tragedy, which we talked about, I was very close to, and longtime listeners know about that as well. It seemed like the medical piece of the advocacy was being hobbled at the federal level. And now we're looking 10 years later. Have things gotten better in terms of the reception that the medical industry and particularly, trauma surgeons that are dealing with gun violence victims on a daily, if not hourly basis? Are you getting the respect and attention that you deserve when laws are being considered?
I think so. It's certainly gotten better since December of 2012. You know, through my work with the American College of Surgeons, we have looked at the surgeons in the United States. About 42% of them are gun owners. And when you ask them, do you support many of the things that public health scientists are recommending, you know, federal research to study gun violence, background checks, restrictions on high-capacity magazines and assault-type firearms, a majority of gun-owning surgeons support those things. And in my mind's eye, that's progress. And as you point out, I think you need to talk to the trusted messengers. When you have trauma surgeons who are gun owners saying that we should study this problem with federal money and we should consider implementing sensible restrictions on firearm ownership, people are much more willing to listen to the gun-owning surgeon than someone who might not, be a gun owner and might have, different priorities.
In the last few minutes that we have with you, I know where you work and have worked. I imagine you have been in the position, and if not you, maybe one of your close colleagues, of having to convey the news to a parent that their child, their niece, nephew, grandson has lost their lives due to gun violence. So if you would, please, Dr. Campbell, in the last few minutes, can you speak directly to the folks that are listening this morning and just convey to them a couple of the most important points that you can make in terms of trying to put a tiny dent from a prevention standpoint in this whole situation?
Sure. The part about my job that's difficult is exactly what you said, is when you have a child or a teenager or an adult, for that matter, who has sustained a gun injury that is fatal. You know, you can't take away the kinetic energy that gets transferred by a bullet that hits human tissue. And I dread more than anything about my job having that discussion where you walk into a room knowing that you're going to change somebody's life in a way that, is going to be awful for everybody involved, and you can't undo. As awful as that is, there is reason for hope. And I think there are some changes and things that are being done and that we can do as responsible Americans to, address the things we've been talking about, making gun ownership as safe as possible. With owning guns comes responsibility. And, there are things that you can do in your house. There are things that you can support at the state and federal level that can, can make an impact on this. And, that's the one thing that if I could convey one message to people who own guns, it's just, take the time to make sure that you are doing everything you can to make the guns in your home as safe as possible, because the results of unintended and sometimes intentional injury with guns can't be reversed.
And you used the important word there, unintentional. So for the legion of individuals out there who fall back on, it's not guns that kill people, it's people that kill people. It's the unintentional that sadly contribute to these 35,000 deaths so far this year and 45,000 in 2020. I'm sorry, in 2020 and 2021. For those who say it's really all about the training and imbuing young people with both experiencing the use and care and the responsibility that comes with firearms, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think people kill people. The guns, the guns aren't the ones that are performing the action.
Sure.
But there are things that we can do with those guns to make it less likely. And again, I think the way I think about it is, you know, suicide. You know, if someone attempts suicide with a gun, there's about a 85% or 90% chance that they're going to succeed. Mm-hmm. If they try by any other means, it's going to be, you know, less than 10%. So I think that illustrates the critical importance of, you know, safe firearm storage. If you have people who are going through behavioral health issues, or a teen who breaks up with their boyfriend or girlfriend. So, you know, that's one thing, but it's also the safe store. You know, if a gun is stored securely in people's home, if a criminal breaks in and can't get it, it's that gun doesn't find its way out into the street where it's misused. So, you know, that's sort of where I get with that. You know, no one's interested in, you know, denying people their, you know, constitutional right to own guns. We just want people to own, you know, to be as safe as possible. And honestly, I think the vast majority of gun owners are safe about it and responsible and want to do the right thing. And I guess I would just conclude by saying what's really interesting is when you talk to sporting groups, hunting groups, pro Second Amendment groups, and then you look at the people on the other side who are just interested in firearm safety, the message is the same. And I think it's finding common ground where you can realize that, you know, whether you're on the left or whether you're on the right, there are a lot of things that we can all agree on, which is we want to reduce the number of children and adults who are harmed by guns in this country. And, you know, hopefully we've identified some of the most important ones in our discussion today.
Well, I hope our discussion has somehow sent something out into the universe that's going to save some lives, which is the ultimate goal of both of us. Dr. Brendan Campbell is a pediatric trauma surgeon at Connecticut Children's and a gun owner himself, and a new friend to the award-winning For the People here. Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for your education and insight and the work that you have to do. Thank you. Well, it's so awesome to hit the midpoint of the program today and have two voices who have separately been involved with us and great resources for us here at the award-winning For the People. And now we have them as a duo. Yes, they are together here for our program highlighting the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. They're right here in the Connecticut office. The NRCS, formerly known as the Soil Conservation Service, is an agency of the United States Department of Agriculture that provides technical assistance and financial assistance to farmers, private landowners, and land managers. And these two individuals here in Connecticut have been doing a great work. State conservationist Tom Mogart has been with us before, as has the assistant state conservationist for programs, Carol Grassis. Thank you both so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, John.
So as we, and Carol, I'm sorry, is it Grassis or Graces?
Grassis.
I thought so. Okay. So let's first, for folks that are listening, give them a quick kind of idea about what the Conservation Service is about, and more importantly, I guess, why we even have you guys here in Connecticut, and how you kind of fit into and complement similar state and nonprofit agencies that are also sort of all rowing in the same direction.
Certainly. So I'll take that. This is Tom. So actually, NRCS, as you said, used to be called the Soil Conservation Service, but before that, we were even called the Soil Erosion Service, and that comes out of the Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
And the Soil Erosion Service got its start when the middle of the country was just eroding through the big winds that were coming across the Great Plains and picking up the topsoil and pushing them all across the country, causing havoc all the way from the center of the country through to the entire East Coast. The story goes that our founder, Hugh Hammond Bennett, our first chief, was testifying before Congress, and he delayed his testimony so that he could pull open a blind during his testimony and show the dust storm coming in over Washington, D.C. Hmm. And that's how we got our start. And we went from soil erosion to helping farmers and ranchers and forest landowners treat their resource concerns on their agricultural properties.
And in terms of the complement and overlap, or sort of the pilot co-pilot maybe situations that your agency and state and things like land trusts and forest associations here in Connecticut, is there a lot of that?
There absolutely is. Through our agricultural conservation easement programs, where we can do easements on agricultural land or wetlands and do restoration projects on those wetlands, we work hand in hand with the Department of Agriculture here in the state and with local land trusts that are interested in putting easements on their land. And we can provide, through an agreement, up to 50% of the easement value on those properties.
So while you are, a conservationist, Tom, like a good broadcaster, you segued beautifully into expanding on what folks need to know about the Conservation Stewardship Program. Let's dive a little deeper and let folks know what it's about and how farmers and landowners and land managers right here in Connecticut can benefit from it.
Sure. So a landowner that's interested in conservation can call our office, and the locations are on our webpage that we'll talk about a little bit later. Mm-hmm. And NRCS will work one-on-one with producers to develop a conservation plan that outlines and enhances their existing conservation activities on their properties. And then we can recommend new conservation practices and activities. And we look at the objectives of that agricultural operator to see what they want to do on their farm or their forest landowner, develop a plan for them that we can then submit an application on their behalf to the agency. And if it's selected for funding, we can help them with financial assistance actually implement that plan on their property.
So to make this a little bit more appreciable on the part of everyone who may be listening, what are a couple of the most prevalent environments, micro environments, I guess I should say, in Connecticut that you are either targeting support toward or that are presenting in these, 2020s? What's happening on the land here in Connecticut that would benefit most from conservation stewardship?
So there are lots of opportunities that are out there, but one that we push all the time is soil health practices. So our farmers already do a great job of addressing, making sure erosion is kept in check, but there are more that we can do. So farmers can implement no-till on their property. They're already doing for the largest part cover crop, but we can do a multi-species cover crop that better feeds the soil. It helps cycle nutrients better, so making nitrogen available for the next crop. It builds the carbon in the soil at the same time. It breaks disease cycles. So that's one of the things we would do there. So really enhancing the health of the soil is a big priority in our state right now.
Do you also play a role in advising individual, and I'm not talking about, property managers or landowners with hundreds of acres, but, maybe an acre or 20 acres or 50 acres. Can you also offer support and education and other services to the average property owner in a suburban or even urban area?
So we work with urban producers. In order to work with us and be eligible for our programs, you have to farm at least a tenth of an acre. Hmm. So that there is a bottom limit on that, but a tenth of an acre is pretty small. And then we help producers all the way up to farming 6,000 and 7,000 acres in this state. So it's a very, very broad spectrum there of those that we can assist. And we work with them every day.
So essentially a few hundred feet by a few hundred feet is the bottom line cutoff.
Correct.
That's
you need
great.
To be an existing agricultural producer for most of our programs, so you need to be growing a crop currently.
Okay, very good. Well, we appreciate the information so far, and we'll be talking more with Carol Grossis as well. Tom Mogart and Carol Grossis are both with us representing the Connecticut office of the United States Department of Agriculture's Natural Resource Conservation Service. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about some exciting developments on the virtual end of things for the NRCS, brand new and improved website and services and access available through it, as well as equity in the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, our friends at the Housatonic Valley Association are excited to share more information about their upcoming auction for the environment. It's coming up on Sunday, November 20th, up at South Farms in Morris. Guests and online auction bidders are going to vie for getaways across France, a VIP package in the exclusive Loud Club at Rolling Loud, and more. Proceeds from HVA's premier fundraiser are going to benefit the organization's Clean, Cold, and Connected Waters, Follow the Forest, and Educate initiatives to protect the Housatonic Valley from the Berkshires to Long Island Sound. A limited number of tickets are still available, and you can purchase them by visiting hvatoday.org. We're back, and thanks for sticking with us. We appreciate your ears this morning and or wherever you may be listening on the podcast. It just proves what you know in your heart, that you care about our environment and the land and everything that comes from it, whether you're a small-scale landowner, a passionate gardener, or a full-scale property manager. You work with a forest association, a land trust, or you are in the agricultural business, which is growing here in Connecticut and definitely benefits from the expertise of folks like we have on the program this morning. Tom Mogart is a state conservationist, and the assistant state conservationist for programs is Carol Grossis. And we've got a few more minutes with them to talk about equity in the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act. Carol, is this something that's on your radar?
Absolutely. Equity under all programs is always on our radar here at NRCS. As your listeners probably know, the Inflation Reduction Act, or the IRA of 2022, is a national bill signed by President Biden in August of 2022, and it represents the single largest investment in climate and clean energy solutions in American history. This filters down through most departments and agencies, and it's come through NRCS, through Chief Terry Cosby's position, that this is the first priority is to ensure that equity is present in the delivery and implementation of all NRCS programs and services. Will have an investment of nearly $20 billion that will be used through NRCS programs over 9 years.
So what is the carve-out for Connecticut, or is that determined by applicants to programs?
That has not been determined yet, that we've just seen a big national level allocation, and as the magic makers work at national headquarters, we'll figure out what each state
suffice to say,
our proportion will be.
Your office is going to administer or oversee some measurable portion of the Inflation Reduction Act funding for these programs. So for folks who are listening that are trying to, kind of put the what they know about the IRA into perspective when it comes to environmental sustainability, how do you foresee the application of any funds going to work here on your watch?
Sure. The funds are going to come to us through our traditional programs, our environmental quality incentives program, the conservation stewardship program that we talked about a little bit earlier, our easement program, and our partnership program, the RCPP. But the focus will be on activities that are designed to mitigate climate impacts and provide some resiliency to climate change. So we will see an increase in the amount of money that we have available to focus on things like nutrient management, specifically nitrogen management, no-till to, again, as Tom mentioned, that it improves soil health, but it will also reduce the number of passes of a tractor over a field. So it reduces the amount of fuel being burned and the amount of emissions coming out. Cover crops that would sequester carbon, and practices identified in an energy audit that could help our producers to reduce the amount of energy that they are using or the amount of emissions that are coming out of their equipment.
Okay. And not to give our listeners backlash, but it just came to mind that Carolyn had reminded me that there's a new round of applications beginning or just started. Is that for the stewardship program?
That is for the stewardship program. We announced our second round with a batching date of December 16th. So we accept applications year-round, and then we announce dates where we would batch them together and consider them in a competitive ranking.
Excellent. Then that brings us around beautifully to the website, because that's where folks can go to learn more about this and apply if they qualify, right?
Correct.
So tell us about the new website. We've got about three or four more minutes. What is new and what additional access and services can be delivered through it?
So it is great that you asked that question. So we have redesigned our web page to be much more customer focused. In the past, our web page was not what we call 508 compliant. So it wasn't very helpful for those individuals with disabilities. So now our website is fully compliant with 508. So if you're disabled, you can use a tool and it will be able to read off the page to you. It wouldn't do that before. So we've made it much more beneficial in that front. We've also have it so that if you go to your favorite search engine, you can go in there and just search for Connecticut NRCS. The page will pop up and all our information will be right there. And you just continue to scroll down the page. Before, you needed to jump over a lot to different pages. Now it's all nested in one page. There are a few links there, but it's really nestled in one spot. So one-stop shopping there. And then we have something called farmers.gov, and I will let Carol take it from there on farmers.gov because she describes it much better than I do.
Great. Carol?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. Farmers.gov is a portal that will allow our program participants to directly access their farm records, which is hosted by our sister agency, the Farm Service Agency, and that we use to plan off of. So it's a fairly simple and straightforward process where our program, people who are interested could register with farmers.gov. They can get in through this portal. They can see their maps of their land. They can see conservation plans that we are developing with them. It's an interactive portal that they can communicate directly with the field office. And then they can e-sign things, which will streamline the experience where they can actually sign an application or a payment request directly through farmers.gov. So we encourage our public and our program participants to utilize this portal because it will streamline and enhance their communications with us and with Farm Service Agency.
Fantastic. Great conversation this morning with State Conservationist Tom Mogart and Assistant State Conservationist for Programs Carol Grassis, both representatives of Connecticut's Office of the Natural Resources Conservation Service, a division of the United States Department of Agriculture, providing technical and financial assistance to farmers and other private land owners and managers. Don't forget, the application process is happening now for the Conservation Stewart program this current round, and money coming in from the IRA to be distributed across a number of programs. So you'll want to visit that website, which is what, Carol?
for the Connecticut NRCS. Mm-hmm. Again, as Tom said, if you Google it, you'll get to find us pretty easily, but the URL is www.ct.nrcs.usda.gov.
Well, we're pleased to welcome back Fernando Urbina. He is our spokesperson in contact with Immigration Help. While not located here in Connecticut, they work with a lot of folks in Connecticut and from all over the country, helping immigrants find freedom, opportunity, and love in the United States without the high cost of an attorney. And Fernando reached out to me a couple of weeks ago because early in October, the Fifth Circuit ruled that DACA was unconstitutional in agreement with anti-immigration Texas Judge Andrew Hanen. So there's a lot that is tied to this decision, and we're going to kind of review that and give you some information. Fernando, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me again, John.
So just remind people exactly what DACA is today and why it's important that folks realize what's happening with this significant group of folks here in America.
Yeah, certainly. So the DACA program was implemented under the Obama administration in 2012 and stands for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And what it essentially does is it allows undocumented young immigrants who arrive to the country at very early ages to be able to get work permits and be deferred from deportation. And so to be eligible for DACA, you have to have entered the country before 2007 and must have been 16 years or younger at the time of entry. And the reason why it's so important is, again, those individuals under the DACA program are able to get legal work permits and also be deferred from deportation. And according to the Center for American Progress, there are currently about 343,000 essential employees under the DACA program, and DACA recipients pay about $6.2 billion in federal taxes per year.
And that's just in federal taxes. It has nothing to do with local, state, or county taxes, or the amount of revenue that they pay into service economy, the grocery stores, the businesses, and commerce in the communities where they live. Significant income generators on a tax basis, as well as in a local, regional income basis. But the bottom line is, the folks who are qualified under DACA are referred to as dreamers, right?
Correct. Yeah. Well, there's currently no way for DACA recipients to become U.S. citizens. And the dreamer name comes from the DREAM Act, which was attempted to be passed before the DACA program, but was not successful. But yeah, there is a push right now in the legislature for hopefully a clear path to citizenship, although there's no currently legislation.
So tell us more about this Fifth Circuit ruling.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, the Texas District Court Judge Hanen had ruled DACA was illegal. And so what he had allowed in that ruling was for DACA renewals to continue, but no new DACA applications to be processed. And so the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the lower court decision and declared that the program was unlawful and has now sent a review back to the lower court for, again, Judge Hanen to take a look at.
And this is leaving somewhere in the neighborhood of a million individuals kind of in limbo?
Exactly. So there are about 600 to 650,000 dreamers at the moment who currently have DACA status, but there are hundreds of thousands more who would be eligible for new applications. But again, they're currently not being processed at the moment because of these court decisions.
So where does an organization like Immigration Help come in terms of helping to advise and support individuals, whether they are already within the application situation or those who hope to file with the idea that at some point in the future, things may change?
So Immigration Help is a legal nonprofit that helps individuals prepare their immigration forms for free. So the way it works is individuals come to our site, they enter their information, and then we prepare right now their DACA renewal application. So all they have to do is file them to the government. And what this does is it saves individuals thousands of dollars in attorney fees they would otherwise have to pay an attorney to complete these same processes. And so we can also help, right now we're helping with renewals, but we can also help individuals prepare their initial applications for when, if there was ever a scenario where new applications would become accepted again.
So for Americans who believe in the good that the DACA program promised, what role could they play in either opposing or supporting some sort of legislative changes? What can be done about the situation as a result of the Fifth Circuit ruling?
That's a great question, John. So the Pew Research Center actually did a study in 2020, and they found that approximately 75% of U.S. adults are actually in favor of permanent legal status for DACA recipients. And so that's 3/4 of the country. And what we encourage individuals to do is these DACA recipients are currently in a state of limbo. And so what needs to happen is for Congress to codify protections for these individuals. And what individuals can do across the country is call their representatives and urge them to pass legislation that is going to protect Dreamers and other immigrants as well.
And has the Fifth Circuit ruling changed anything in terms of the, a risk to these 600,000 to 1 million plus individuals to get deported or to face any type of action in regards to either their current employment or their employability, their ability to access services, whether it's state, federal, or local?
Not really. So the Department of Homeland Security in August created a new rule that was in an attempt to codify the Obama era policy or memorandum related to DACA. And so what the Fifth Circuit Appeals Court has done is basically sent that rule back to Judge Hainan to review. But at the moment, nothing really changes for DACA recipients. You're still only able to renew. You can't apply for new status, and the eligibility process remains the exact same.
So for those who have not yet applied, is it pertinent to them that they at least kind of get all the ducks lined up and get the application prepared so that when and if the opportunity opens up for them to get into the system, so to speak, that it's, ready to flip the switch?
Yeah, exactly. So if DACA were ever to start accepting new applications again, or the government, were able to start accepting new applications for DACA, you would want to be ready to file and get yourself in line for those protections as soon as possible.
And so that's where your organization comes in. Now, is Immigration Help a standalone nonprofit, located here in the Northeast, but serving essentially anyone who comes to you from anywhere in the country? Or are you part of a network of similar types of initiatives based across the country that are all doing something of the same type of support work?
So we're a standalone organization. We're based in Boston. But again, like you mentioned, we help individuals across the entire country because we're an online platform. But that said, we are trying to partner with other organizations that also help immigrants because We're definitely stronger when we stand together, and there is a lot of synergy between our works. And the more people we can connect to the resources that they need, obviously, the better.
Very good. If we can switch gears in the last few minutes that we have with you, Fernando, DACA is by far not the only thing in terms of immigration happenings. You know, we've got this election looming. Certainly there's going to be potential political ramifications. But in terms of the situation in Afghanistan, say, or in the in Ukraine, what's happening with folks who are still coming to the United States seeking refuge from those countries?
So what's happening is we're seeing delays in processing times. And I think in part this may be because, like you mentioned, the elections are looming and immigration is always a big talking point on both sides of the aisle. And so what we tend to see a lot of times around election time is that these different policies get leveraged in order to engage voters one way or another, which is unfortunate, but a reality.
And what are you seeing in terms of, you know, the proportion or the volume of individuals coming to immigration help who are particularly from either of those countries? What's going on with folks from Ukraine in terms of influx to the United States? I know there's, you know, even at the local level here across Connecticut, many faith-based communities and service organizations are ready to or are welcoming Ukraine families and refugees. What are you seeing there coming out of that war-torn country?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So I actually don't have too much insight into refugees from Ukraine at the moment. I will say, though, that just recently we have partnered with the Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project, or ASAP, and we are going to be working with them to provide their members or help their members get asylee work permits and be able to work legally in the United States once they're able to obtain asylum status. And so we are going to be working closely with asylees in the future, but at the moment we don't have too much insight.
Well, and certainly the last time we talked to you, we were almost hyper-focused on the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. Certainly mm-hmm. things have not gotten any better. If anything, they've gotten substantially worse. What can you tell our listeners about what you're seeing from that group of folks coming to look for refuge in the United States?
We definitely continue to see a big number of individuals wanting refuge in the United States from a number of countries, Ukraine, Afghanistan, also many, many countries in Central America as well. And obviously these individuals just want a better life for their families and themselves and their future children, future grandchildren. It's really important that when we're talking about refugees and individuals seeking refuge in the United States, that we think of them as humans and remember that they have basic human rights and basic needs as well. And they're not coming to the United States just because they want to leave their countries. Many of them love their home countries, but they're just not in positions to be able to stay there or are unsafe staying there. And so because of that, it's really important also that Congress takes these things into consideration and passes legislation to protect more and more of these individuals.
And I'm sure you can speak from experience. So many of these individuals are in fear for their lives and the lives of their children.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Many of the countries that they're coming from are in deep economic crises. They're war stricken, huge amounts of violence. And so, again, they're coming to the United States in hopes of a better future for themselves and their families.
Well, we appreciate your organization and your team up there in Boston, Fernando. The U.S. government, as we hear, is only granting DACA renewals, but you can still submit a new DACA application to hold your place in line. Immigration Help is there for you, helping immigrants find freedom, opportunity, and love in the United States without the high cost of an attorney, with a great degree of success since its inception online. Since 2019 and serving individuals across the country. ImmigrationHelp.org is their website, and Fernando Urbina is our spokesperson here on the award-winning For the People in Connecticut. Fernando, best of luck to you, and we'll be circling back again to talk, I'm sure, before we get too far into the new year. So thanks for your time. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.